The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Recap of last night's Oscars, and then an anniversary many of us would probably like to forget. You're listening to The Common Good. Happy Monday, friends. Welcome to The Common Good here on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us on this Monday afternoon. Hope that you had a great weekend, a great first day of work this week. We got beautiful weather already starting, but really coming our way. It's a big deal in my house. My son is at their high school, is on the baseball team. My daughter is on the softball team. First games tomorrow. And what you're used to as a baseball and softball parent in the Chicagoland area is that when these games roll around in the early spring, and they'll come, it'll happen this year, but when they roll around, it tends to be 40 degrees and raining, or a little bit of ice, or it gets snowed out. I told you last year my son's team had like three of their first 10 games got played because of weather. Well, his team plays Tuesday and Wednesday of this week, and it's supposed to be 65 degrees and sunny, like actual baseball weather. So I do not know what to do with that, but we're excited to get the seasons rolling. It's kind of a rite of passage into spring. Some of you are, you know, basketball families or hockey families, or our family is spring sport family, baseball. I mean, my kids play fall sports, but baseball, softball, love being outside, love getting to know the parents. So excited for that to kick off our first pitch, play ball tomorrow. And it will could not be a more beautiful week. Hope that you had a great weekend. I wonder what you did this weekend. I after church yesterday, did some work. As I've been telling you, we're merging churches. And so did some work over at the other church, helping get it ready. Came home, watched a little bit of women's basketball. And it was super exciting until a brawl broke out in the LSU South Carolina game, and there was a leadership lesson in it. You could go check it out if you Google. At the end of the game, LSU and South Carolina had a little bit of a dust-up, and the South Carolina coach, Dawn Staley, was, I apologize, you know, heat of the moment, but this isn't what our program is about. Kim Mulkey, the coach of LSU, was like, took a different tact and said, I wish the South Carolina girl had come after one of our bigger girls. Different ways to own your responsibility, and a great leadership lesson right there. But the highlight of the night, or the big part of the night for many of you, was the Oscars. The Oscars happened last night, and Oppenheimer basically swept the major categories. Best picture, best actor, best supporting actor, best director. And it really does kind of add to the buzz. I've never seen Oppenheimer, but I told my wife last night, oh, maybe we should watch the movie. Maybe we should see it soon. So that swept the categories. But there were certain parts of the show last night that really jumped out. I didn't watch much of it, but I watched the recap of it. So Ryan Gosling, who played Ken in Barbie, singing I'm Just Ken was probably the highlight of the night. It was really good. John Cena coming across the stage essentially naked, pretending to be a streaker. Little weird, little strange. Probably could have done without that. Jimmy Kimmel, I always think, is a funny host, reading the Truth Social post in real time from former President Trump. Kind of funny. Punctuated by his line, isn't it a little bit past your jail time? Not bad, not bad. But basically, Oppenheimer was the talk of the night. But my favorite part, if you know my favorite movie of all time, or one of my favorite movies being Field of Dreams, John Mulaney, just the hilarious comedian. Most people think he's going to host this
in the future. John Mulaney got up to do an award and basically did a funny bit about the movie Field of Dreams. You got to hear this. Listen to John Mulaney's thing last night.
Or what about that moment in Field of Dreams when we hear, if you build it, he will come. And then Costner does it. He builds a baseball field. Or I guess he doesn't build it. He mows down corn, and then there is a field. And then he's like, I'm going to watch Ghost play baseball. And the bank is like, you want to pay your mortgage? And he's like, nah, I'm going to watch Ghost play baseball. And then he finds James Earl Jones, who wrote The Boat Rocker, which I thought was a real book deep into my 20s. And he's like, people will come, Ray. He's the only one with a financial plan. But what's weird is Timothy Busfield pushes little Gabby Hoffman off the bleachers, and she falls down, and she's unconscious. Then Burt Lancaster is Moonlight Graham, and he comes up and he pats her on the back a couple times, and he's like, hot dog stuck in the throat. And then he can't go back in the game, because I guess there's a rule in ghost baseball that if you leave the field at any point to become an elderly ghost and do the Heimlich maneuver, you can't return to the field. I love Field of Dreams. That should win Best Picture.
I love that, not only because Field of Dreams probably every year should win Best Picture, but how gutsy for John Mulaney to just get up there and just riff about Field of Dreams and retell the story. And he did highlight one of the most surprising aspects of Field of Dreams, didn't he? Or one of the most confusing aspects. It's a game of ghosts, but when Moonlight Graham, the doctor, steps out to save the daughter, he can't go back. And yeah. I'd love John Mulaney there. It's just ghost baseball, the rules of ghost baseball, but a hilarious portion. So the Oscars, a major portion of the evening, of the weekend, a lighthearted one. We're going to talk about more serious stuff as the day goes on. Some things said by President Biden, by former President Trump. Friends, we are moving forward. I had my first politician show up at my door yesterday. Talking more about the primary coming up, something she was running for locally. She was great. It was, I had a nice conversation with her, but it did remind me, okay, we're in political season. It is upon us, and buckle up. Here we go. And just a reminder, I had the conversation again with somebody at our church yesterday. They were just struggling with the culture we live in, what's going on in the world around us, punctuated by the presidential election that is coming. And I reminded them again, hey, this is going to be tough. Limit how much social media look at. Limit your cable news intake. There's more to the world than who wins the next election. And ultimately, remember, Jesus is on the throne. Jesus is not on the ballot come November. And so we don't need to get all worked up. We don't need to get all fired up. We don't need to get ride the highs and lows, because there's a lot out there right now, but we do not need to be controlled by it. So glad to have you with us on this Monday, March the 11th. And that date should stick out to you. Possibly should stick out to you. Let me remind you why March 11th is a big deal. Today marks the fourth anniversary of when the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 as a pandemic. Today is the four-year anniversary of that. Today is also the four-year anniversary to when many of us were confronted with this COVID-19 pandemic. You might remember there was an NBA basketball game, the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Utah Jazz. The Oklahoma City Thunder and the Utah Jazz were playing a game in Utah. And Utah center, Rudy Gobert, he tested positive for COVID. So you were watching the game, and all of a sudden, or even if you weren't watching, all of a sudden word spread that they were delaying the start of the game. What's going on? There was already high anxiety about COVID-19. What is this? You might remember 4 years ago at this time, the cruise ships were being parked and people weren't being let off. And you're watching this basketball game on ESPN. And then all of the sudden, they're not starting the game. What's going on? What's going on? And then it comes out that Rudy Gobert had tested positive for COVID. And at this point, you're like, is that a death sentence? What does that even mean? And they canceled the game. And they told everybody to leave the arena. And that's when it became really real. Like, again, right now, 4 years later, for many of us, we have a different thought process of COVID-19 or a different perspective. Like now, if you hear somebody has COVID because of the new strains, but also because we're just know what it is much better, know how to deal with it. Now, if you hear somebody has COVID, you're like, all right, no big deal. You know, you're going to miss a day or two of work. Hope you feel better, but there's not the fear. But do you remember 4 years ago? Do you remember what that was like? Just like, oh, do I have a scratchy throat? What's going on? And wait, stuff's closing down. And I believe that was a Wednesday. And then on Friday, which happened to be Friday the 13th, that's when it got really real. And all of the school, I'll never forget sitting in a Pete's Coffee in a meeting and my texts going off from my wife and from other people going, hey, they're sending the kids home. They're sending the kids home. Schools are closing. And for us as pastors, it was, what do we do about Sunday? What do we do coming up? And again, as happens in our culture, a lot of it has been politicized. A lot of it is just revisionist history. But in that moment, you're like, gosh, do we need to close down everything? And that's what happened. And I remember going home going, what in the world? What is going on? Do you remember what that was like? Like, again, so much has changed about COVID over the last 4 years, but go put yourself back 4 years ago and remember what was happening, how it felt. And then I remember that first week being, am I allowed to admit this? It was kind of fun. All right, you got kids aren't going to school. Mom and dad, we can't go do anything. We're all going to be home. My son and I watched a Rocky movie each night. So those first 4 or 5 nights we watched, I stop at Rocky 4. So those first 4 nights we watched Rocky 1, Rocky 2, Rocky 3, Rocky 4. Because at that point we thought we'd be home for a week, 2 weeks. We didn't realize that they wouldn't go back to school and they wouldn't start school the next year. We didn't realize that many of us were going to not have regular church again for months. We didn't realize that now we had to understand words like social distancing and masks and all of the other things that came with COVID-19 that made it really scary. I remember like 2 weeks in, I got a cold and I was scared. Again, don't think about how we view it now. Remember what it was like 4 years ago. Gosh, I don't think we'll ever go back to anything like that, but I also know that I really hope we never do. And it reminds us of fear. Like, as Christ followers, what do we do when things feel out of control? What is the answer when you're afraid? Like COVID-19 beginnings. Again, I'm trying to bring us back to 4 years ago, to when it was all starting, before it was like, we all took our sides. But before that, when the fear and the unknown was still part of it, how do we deal with fear and uncertainty? Not just of a global pandemic, but maybe some of you are dealing with cancer. Maybe you're dealing with an unknown work environment situation. Maybe an unknown relationship where you're not sure how it's going to, if it's going to reconcile itself. How do we deal with fear and uncertainty? Over and over and over again, New Testament and Old Testament, we read this short phrase. Do not fear. Do not be afraid. And if that's where the verse stopped, if that's where the command, it's a command, that if that's where the command of God stopped, then I would think that that's an unfair verse. Like, well, I don't know. Fear is a normal emotion. Fear is a normal part of life. When you get that bad diagnosis at the doctor's office, fear is natural. So when it says, do not fear, but then it always comes with a promise. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not fear, for I am with you. The promised presence of God. The promise that God says, I will be with you. I will be near you. Jesus picks up this promise himself, right? When he is sending the disciples out right before he ascends into heaven, Jesus is sending the disciples out in what we call the Great Commission. And Jesus says, I will be with you always, even to the ends, even to the last days. I will be with you always. Do not fear. God says to Joshua, right? Joshua's about to take over for Moses and lead the Israelites. Do not fear. Do not fear. Do not fear, for I am with you. Does the promised presence of God, the active presence of God, make a difference in your life? As you face the things in your life, whether it be 4 years ago, a global pandemic, job situation now, whatever else it might be, do you still stare those things down and go, yes, they cause me anxiety, they cause me fear, but I will not live in fear. I will not be controlled by fear. Why? Because God is with me. The real, active, promised presence of God is the antidote to fear. It's not pretend there's nothing to be fearful about. That's not helpful. There are things in this world that are fear-inducing, anxiety-inducing, but we are promised peace. We are promised comfort because of the presence of God. I will be with you always. How's that do for you today? Regardless of what you're facing, we're reminded of the things in life that cause fear by this 4-year anniversary. Take some time to reflect on it today. Take some time to reflect on it, but be reminded that God is bigger than any global pandemic or any fear-inducing thing that we might face. There's been a lot of talk, sadly, or maybe it's a good thing, but in the Christian world over the last couple of weeks about what does manliness look like? What is manhood look like? And this is an important conversation. What is biblical manhood, but what are cultural constructs? What does it look like to be a man? Where is that breaking down in our culture? I think those are important conversations. Now, it went a little bit off the rails this weekend, I would suggest, when a viral tweet went around about there's literally a room full of just men. I think it was the Shepherd's Conference, I think at MacArthur's Church. If not, I could be wrong. It could have been somewhere else, where they were singing a hymn led by Bob Coughlin, and this guy tweeted saying that this is a problem. This song's effeminate. He used the word effeminate, and he went on this rant about what manliness is and effeminate songs and all of this stuff. And it was kind of ridiculous. Not kind of, it was ridiculous. A lot of people pushed back, but a lot of people also agreed with him. And it raises this question that's been riding around Twitter, I think, about what does a man look like? What are the attributes of a man and of a woman? And or what are we getting right culturally? What is just cultural versus what is actually biblical? And so Thinking about that, there was a podcast the other day, and I played something from his retirement ceremony the other day, but Jason and Travis Kelce, not believers. This is why I thought this was interesting in this conversation. Two football players, they're brothers. You know the name Travis Kelce right now because he is the football player who's dating Taylor Swift. Both future Hall of Famers, Jason Kelce, just retired as one of the best offensive centers ever playing for the Philadelphia Eagles. Travis Kelce just won a Super Bowl as a tight end for the Kansas City Chiefs. They have a wildly successful podcast, and they were on their podcast the other day talking about Jason's retirement. And what I want to play is Travis talking to his brother and reflecting on what his big brother's career has meant to him. And I think in this, we see a picture of some things that some people, I would say, aren't what men are supposed to do. But these are two rugged, manly men. And I want you to see if you pick up what I'm talking about. There's a couple aspects. These are two brothers who have played, grown up together, played football. Now their lives are changing a little bit. But also, these are guys. These are men. These are football players. I want you to hear what Travis said as he reflected on with his brother about his brother's retirement.
We did not talk about much of your retirement, and I wanted to make sure that you didn't feel any pressure from me to keep going, knowing I wanted you to keep going. I wanted you to keep playing this game.
Why didn't you tell me this? I would have changed my mind.
No. You've always been a step ahead of me in
I'm older, Trey.
In this game. Yeah, but it's in this game alone, you've always been a step ahead of me, and it's always been like I've had that flotation device right there to have you out of it. Man, it feels empty, and it definitely it feels like it's complete, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a success.
I hear you.
It was a fun journey to watch, and and like I said yesterday, man, I just appreciate you showing me the way and bringing us all along the journey with you, big guy.
We showed each other the way. You've been playing for a long time on your own, and I look forward to being able to appreciate and watch your games more and take in the bigger picture of football and everything that it has to offer.
Well, it was cool being the tag team
hey!
Of the National Football League.
All right, so what stood out to me there? What stood out to you? There were two things. The first is this. You might have heard a pause in the middle there. That pause was there because they both were crying. They both were crying. And Travis and Jason at Jason Kelce's retirement press conference the other day, Jason Kelce immediately started crying. And Travis, there were many shots of him in the audience crying, wearing sunglasses. He was crying that hard. They've both been very open about their emotions. Somewhere along the way, for many guys in our culture, it has been taught and handed down that men don't show emotion. Men don't cry. And so I think there's something so helpful here to see two football players, two manly men on video, on audio, to each other crying. Men, there's nothing unmanly about crying. Yet oftentimes we hand down this picture of manhood to our sons that says a real man doesn't cry. Do you want to know why we know a real man cries? There's a very short verse in the Bible that says Jesus wept. Jesus wept. Men were created with emotion. And men cry. And I appreciate these two putting this clip out there of them crying. And the other thing I want to highlight here is this is two brothers who clearly love each other. And the younger brother, Travis, says publicly to his older brother, Jason, I appreciate you. I love you. It's not even one thing to show emotion, but the idea that they speak words of love and affirmation to each other, that they show love to one another. Like, again, this is a messed aspect of masculinity. Like, there's this strength and machismo that we have that says never show emotion and never display emotion, never share emotion, never tell those close to you that I love you, never hug those close to you, never say I appreciate you. You've meant a lot to me. There's something over the generations that has said this isn't manly, and that's to our detriment. Men, show emotion, feel emotion, express your emotions, express it to your wife, express it to those other guys who are close to you, those mentors in your life. I appreciate you. I appreciate you. I respect you. I love you. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, this is a picture of secure manliness, manhood, to be expressive in this way. Somewhere along the way, we've been passed down through the generations that men are distant. Men are, we don't have emotion. We don't show emotion. And friends, I think that that is a, that's not only a lie, but it is detrimental to the man, to us as men, and to our sons who are coming up behind us, who are watching us. Show your emotions. Speak your emotions. Tell your kids you love them. Let your kids see you tell your wife, their mom, that you love her. That's manliness. Jesus wept. That's manliness. Not just this false machismo and this emotional wall that can be set up. Let's do away with that. So grateful for even this small clip from the Kelce brothers. Hey, before I dive into politics and political pandering, we should note that Courtney Cronin from ESPN Chicago is reporting today that there's been a major shift in the Chicago Bears' plans to build a new stadium remaining in Chicago, as the franchise is committing $2 billion to help fund a publicly owned dome stadium south of the current Soldier Field site. Now, who knows if this is going to end up happening? They could still end up in Arlington Heights. But what do you think about a dome stadium south of current Soldier Field? Like, right there in the same parking lot, basically, with a dome, they can host Super Bowls, concerts, Final Fours, amongst other things than just Bears games. A lot of talk. I thought it was a done deal, them heading to Arlington Heights. And this, that could still be where they end up, because they still own the property of the old racetrack up in Arlington Heights. So it's a $2 billion that they're going to commit to help fund a publicly owned dome stadium. I don't know how much they're asking for from the public. This could still be another $1 billion from the city and the state. Something worth it. It's the business of sports. So the Bears, the key part here is the Bears may end up still in the city of Chicago, but what's it going to cost? We're going to see all of this as it plays out. The Bears kind of have both things working right now. And going to be interesting to see what happens. All right, I mentioned this earlier. It's political pandering time of year, where politicians say one thing, then stick their finger up to figure out which way the wind is going, and then say something altogether different. The latest example of this is our current president, Joe Biden, speaking specifically about what he said in the State of the Union address when he called the killer of Lakin Riley, which is just a terrible story. That nursing student in Georgia who was brutally killed. And during the State of the Union address, President Biden called her accused killer illegal because he came into this country illegally. President Biden was asked Friday if he regretted describing the immigrant who allegedly murdered Lakin Riley as an illegal. And he said this, well, not probably. I don't regret. Technically, he's not supposed to be here. Well, then he was asked again on Saturday on MSNBC. Does he regret it? Let's listen to what he had to say.
But during your response to her heckling of you, you used the word illegal when talking about the man who allegedly killed Lakin Riley.
An undocumented person. And I shouldn't have used illegal. It's undocumented. And look, when I spoke about the difference between Trump and me, one of the things I talked about on the border was that his, the way he talks about vermin, the way he talks about these people polluting the blood. I talked about what I'm not going to do, what I won't do. I'm not going to treat any of these people with disrespect. Look, they built the country. The reason our economy is growing, we have to control the border and more orderly flow. But I don't share his view at all.
So you regret using that word?
Yes.
So somewhere there was a change of heart. There was also clips going around from Joe Biden in the last decade or two speaking about illegal immigration much differently than he is now. But this is just pandering. People got to him and said, hey, no, this is the messaging that we need. I read a tweet where somebody said to this, I'm glad he fixed this. We wouldn't want to disrespect a murderer by saying something true about his legal status. But somebody got to President Biden. This is, I bring this up to say this. I don't even want to talk about immigration and this story. This story is unbelievably sad. But what I do want to talk about is this. We are in that time of year, and it's going to get worse, where serious subjects are just, it's just pandering. So here, President Biden is just pandering to his base. Oh, shoot, we can't call them illegal. We must call them undocumented and go from there. And then Republicans, if I could be honest, and I'm like I told you, I'm a lifelong Republican. It's ugly how they're using this girl's murder, in my opinion, as a talking point, as a political victory. I wish everyone would just say, this is tragic. We're sad. We've got to fix this. Instead of, you know, using her name on either side to score political points. I hate that. I hate that we do that, but that's our politics of these days. And if you think that it's just one side of the aisle that looks for which way the political winds are going, I would just submit to you that for most of his pre-political life, Donald Trump was very pro-choice. He's now one of the strongest pro-life presidents there is. Is that for political reasons? Did he have a change of heart? Call me skeptical. This is the time of year where politicians are more than happy to change their views for political reasons. Go back and look at what the Clintons and President Obama said about same-sex marriage. And the list goes on and on and on about abortion, about other things, what people have said, and realize how people change their tune. Friends, we know this about our politicians. But there's a reason that the Bible says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Be people whose word matters. Be men and women whose word holds something. Are you like me? I don't trust anything that any politician says. And that might sound unfair, but it's true because that's the track record. Politicians will lie. Politicians will change their tune in order to get votes. They'll see which way the political winds are blowing and they'll put their sail up there. We're used to it. But that should never, ever be how we as Christians respond in any way. We have to be people of principle. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. I would respect greater the politicians. You're like, listen, I said it. I mean it. It may not be popular, but this is what I think. But we get this. President Biden says one thing in the State of the Union, backs it up on Friday, completely changes his tune on Saturday. Do we really think that he changed his mind? No, just politics. It's just politics. And we're used to it, but that doesn't make it okay. And it can't be the way that we as Christians talk. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. I want to talk about the difficulties of life. Ironically, I wish I'd found this article the other day because on Sunday, yesterday at our church, I preached about the storms of life and that we as Christians, as we mature, what's the calling in our life? To be rooted. That's the word we talked about. And how are we rooted? Because throughout the Bible, it talks about us being rooted, being planted. And how is it that when the storms of life come, we stay up? We're able to stand. I told the story of a house in Mexico Beach, Florida, that after Hurricane Michael hit in 2018 and the sun came up, there was immense devastation. Everything was flattened except for one house was standing, and it looked like it hadn't even been touched. Now, the inside, they had some issues, but structurally, it looked like it hadn't been touched. And people were asking, was this a miracle? What happened? And then they went back and they interviewed the owner, and the owner said, basically, we went above and beyond, way above code to make sure. And here was his line. We wanted to construct this so it could survive the big one. The big one. And here's the question for us today. Are our lives built in such a way to survive the big one? And how do we do that? We understand that Jesus says, build your house upon a rock that is him, a firm foundation. Build it upon a firm foundation where wind and waves come crashing, but they will not take it down. And basically what I said in the midst of our sermon, looking at a couple different texts, was this. We withstand the storms of life as we remember that God loves us more than we could ever imagine. The book of Ephesians says that we would know how wide and high and deep is the love of Christ in our lives. That we know even in the midst of the storms, he loves us. He's present. We also know that he's powerful. We become people who love the word, which the book of Psalms says makes us like trees planted by streams of living water. And we begin obeying and follow him now when things aren't bad. And that builds us up, our faith in him, and roots us into the firm foundation. Is your life ready for the big one? Because Jesus says in John 16, in this world, you will have trouble. It's not an if, it's a when. I get it. We are creatures. We live in a culture that that idolizes comfort. But there is coming a day where you will have problems. If it's not now, it's coming. The big one is coming. How do we root our lives? But over Christianity Today, they asked a different question. Why storms are necessary for survival? Is there something actually positive about the storms of life? Not easy, but is there something in them that grows us and that we learn from? So I wanted to read this over Christianity Today. Because I thought it was really interesting. He talks about the evening, this author talks about laying in a hospital bed and that evening where he got some could be difficult news. He ended up being okay. He said a storm rolled in over the city. The soothing sound of rain drew me out of my bed for the first time in days, and I ambled like an old man to a chair beside the window, hearing the raindrops pelt and then run in down the windowsill. Closing my eyes, he says, I pondered the mystery of trials as a Bible verse echoed, James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. Consider it pure joy, brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance, let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. He says, for me, this passage had often seemed like sadistic pining for pain. As one who had lived much of his life determined to outrun discomfort, that's a great way to put it. I would put myself in that as well. The notion of taking joy in struggle was anathema. Didn't being a believer invite blessing? How on earth could the pain and suffering of trials be considered pure joy? In the 1980s, a research facility, he writes, called Biosphere 2, built a closed ecosystem to test what it would take to eventually colonize space. Everything was carefully curated and provided for. The trees planted inside sprung up and appeared to thrive. Then they begin to fall. He says, I imagine the botanists must have looked on in dismay, finding no evidence of disease or mite. There was nothing to cause the trees to topple. The conditions were perfect. And then they realized what was missing, something so simple, yet absent within the confines of the structure: wind. The air was too still, too serene, an ease that guaranteed the trees were doomed. It's the pressure and variation of natural wind that causes the trees to strengthen and their roots to grow. Though the trees of Biosphere 2 had all the sun, soil, and water they needed, in the absence of changing winds, they built no resilience and eventually fell under the weight of their own abundance. Could it be that our difficulties, more than our delights, are what drives us closer to God? They remind us of our desperation and lead us back to the sole source of abundant life. Romans chapter 5, verses 3 through 5 encourages us this way. We also glory in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope. Hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. He says, I spent most of the night by that window as the rain continued to fall, drifting in and out of sleep as my body continued to heal. I felt the peace of God like a warm embrace, reminding me that he'd been with me every step of my near-death journey, filling that hospital room with his spirit. As we journey through the struggle-filled season of Lent, he writes, we can begin to see trials and storms in that way. Though we may still have a strong aversion to pain, we can see the hand of God when the winds of trial come to buffet, and we can take solace in the fact that our roots grow deeper. He then asks two questions. As you think through your life, how have your difficult experiences changed you for the good? What did you learn? And then he said, in your darkest times, what did God teach you about himself? How did he comfort you and help you? Is there anyone in your life, be they friends or family, who you might encourage today through sharing your story? I think that's a powerful picture of the wind, what the wind does to a tree, that a tree cannot exist without the variations and the buffeting and the pressure of the wind. What would our faith be if we never had struggle? Would our roots ever actually grow deep? An interesting way to think about the struggles of this world. Well, we're glad that you joined us today. If you missed any of the show, go get the podcast, wherever it is you get your podcast. Just subscribe, rate, review. We hope that you join us again tomorrow from 4 until 6. Until then, have a wonderful evening. My name is Brian Fromm. You've been listening to The Common Good here on AM 1160. Hope for your life.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn. deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.